So I want to first of all give you, and I apologise for doing this to you on a Sunday morning, I want to give you a picture, really, of what it might have been like to be with a bunch of people who were worshipping the Canaanite gods, who associated with the name Baal, most commonly in the Bible. And the worship would tend to sort of start in a shrine, in a sacred place. And the shrine would normally be a tree in the somewhere in the centre of the community. But sometimes, perhaps if there wasn't a suitable tree, they'd erect their own sort of pole, and they'd call it an Asherah pole. And you read about Asherah poles in the Bible as well. And the people who turned up early, they would be free to visit one of the prostitutes who were professionally employed at the scene of the shrine. Male and female prostitutes according to your preference. And as people gathered, then a fire would be lit, because the worship would take place around a fire, and the crowd would build. And scenes of excitement as things sort of started to warm up, and they started to make offerings to the gods, to Baal. And most commonly, that was sort of cakes made with flour and raisins, was thought to be something that the local Baal would appreciate. If it was a time of particular stress or a time of particular importance, maybe certain times of the year, then the offerings would need to be a little bit bigger. And so the priests of Baal would choose a suitable child from the community and take the child away from the parent, restrain the mother, who undoubtedly would be howling and screaming in terror, knowing what was going to happen. They'd slit the child's throat and they'd burn the child in the fire. And then, as the sort of the smell of the offerings burning and the charred flesh of the child sort of smoked around the place where everyone was worshipping, then the real sort of fun, as they'd see it, would begin. And people would just undress this robe, and the orgy would begin. And the whole thing was supposed to sort of celebrate the fertility of the gods, and so you'd celebrate the fertility by group sex with whoever you wanted. And that was sort of worship of the Baal. Of Baal and of Asherah. And to make sense of why people would do this, you perhaps need to understand what they thought of the Baals. And the idea was that there was one kind of like Lord Baal, which nobody really talked about very much. And he and his mistress, Asherah, had many offspring. And each of their offspring would be a different Baal. Each of them would have a different name, and they would live in a different place. So each village or each community, each area of the land would have its own Baal. And that Baal, that god, would be looking to live from the land, and so they'd need to take offerings to him. And so he'd want food, and he'd want children. And so they'd make their offering. And the local Baal would make the land fertile if the people showed their appreciation of the act that had brought him into being. And so, hence the sexual acts around it. And so they thought that this licentiousness was a way of making sure that their land would be productive and they'd get good crops. And so they needed to placate the Baals. And the Baals cared very little. They cared nothing at all, in fact, for how people actually lived. All they cared, so the people thought, was that they were actually provided with what they needed. So provided the people sort of celebrated in their sexual behaviour the fertility that they would bring, and provided them, they gave them their cakes of raisins and their children, then Baal would be happy. Baal didn't care how they lived. And that contrasted hugely with the worship of the Lord, which would be adhered to by other parts of the community, who said that actually God doesn't really care very much about offerings and burnt offerings. He cares about your heart. And so Micah famously says in that well-known verse, "He has shown you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you?" And look at the contrast with what Baal requires of you. What does the Lord require of you? But to act justly and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. So two complete contrasts. On the one hand, you've got gods who don't care what you do, as long as you visit the shrines and the prostitutes and give them your cakes, and hopefully somebody else's child, not yours. And on the other hand, you've got the Lord, who cares about even what you think and wants every part of you. And so you can understand why for many people the appeal and the attraction was to indulge in the Baal worship and to put worship of the Lord to one side. And Israel had been told, when they first inhabited the land of Israel, they'd been told to stamp out worship of the Canaanite gods, to get rid of worship of Baal and of Asherah. And they failed to do it. And in fact, the practices didn't really die out until after the end of the Old Testament, until around about the 2nd or 3rd century BC, around about the time of the Maccabees, which is in the sort of intertestamental period. And it's against that background that you perhaps can begin to understand, when you sort of read the prophets and you read the stories of the kings, why it is that God is so disgusted with worship of the Canaanite gods, of the Baals. And in amongst that, perhaps towards the end of it, there was a man called Hosea. And Josie has just read us some of the things that he wrote. And we know exactly when Hosea lived, because he very helpfully tells us what was going on at the time when he was alive. And it says, "The word of the Lord, which came to Hosea, son of Beeri, during the reigns of Uzziah and Jotham and Ahaz and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and during the reign of Jeroboam, son of Joash, king of Israel." So we know exactly when Hosea was alive. And at the time he was alive, Israel, as we now know it, the land of Israel, was split up into two. And there was a northern kingdom called Israel and a southern kingdom called Judah. And they had different kings, and their kings did different things. And it's interesting because, of course, you can never read anything in the Bible without sort of taking it into its context. And I'm sure that you all understand that. It's helpful to understand a little bit about who the kings were who were alive while Hosea was alive, around about the middle to the end of the 8th century BC. So if we take those kings of Judah first, and we can read about them, and you can find them if you want to, or I can just tell you. Uzziah was the first one. We read about him in 2 Chronicles, and 2 Chronicles chapter 26 tells us this about Uzziah. It says, "The people of Judah, acting together, took Uzziah, now 16 years old, and made him king in succession to his father Amaziah. It was he who built Eloth and restored it to Judah. Uzziah was 16 years old when he came to the throne, and he reigned in Jerusalem for 52 years. His mother was Jechaliah from Jerusalem. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, as Amaziah his father had done. He set himself to seek the guidance of God in the days of Zechariah, who instructed him." And so on. And we can read an awful lot about what happened in Uzziah's day. But basically, Uzziah was on the side of those who wanted to worship the Lord, and not those who wanted to worship Baals and Asheroth. And then similarly, we can read about Jotham, who was the king who followed him. And he was 25 when he came to the throne. He reigned in Jerusalem for 16 years. And his mother was Jerusha, daughter of Zadok. And he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. So another king in Judah, in the southern of the two kingdoms, who was really trying to gradually get rid of the Baal worship and the Asherah worship, but and he largely did good. And then he was succeeded by Ahaz, and we can read about him in Chronicles as well. And in chapter 28 of Chronicles, it tells us this, that he was 20 years old when he came to the throne, and he reigned in Jerusalem for 16 years. And he did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord, his forefather David, but followed in the footsteps of the kings of Israel. Kings of Israel to the north, who tended to prefer Baal and Asherah to the Lord. And he cast metal images for the Baalim. He also burnt sacrifices in the valley of Ben Hinnom. He even burnt his sons in the fire, according to the abominable practices of the nations whom the Lord had dispossessed in favor of the Israelites. He sacrificed and burned offerings at the shrines and on the hilltops and under every spreading tree. So suddenly we have a king called Ahaz who's now taking the Israelites back, or the people of Judah back, to worshipping Baal and Asherah. And it's interesting to kind of, when you go through and read a little bit more, you sort of see that that Uzziah was a he had great military successes and dealt with the Philistines and the Ammonites, who were continually attacking the Jews. And there was a time of economic prosperity under Uzziah, the first good king that we mentioned. Under Jotham, the second good king that we mentioned, there was economic success and there was military success again. Under Ahaz, there were enormous military losses. He was defeated by the Philistines. He was defeated by the Edomites. He was defeated by the Aramites. And most notably of all, he was defeated by the Israelites, who were the kingdom to the north, which killed 120,000 of the people of Judah and took another 200,000 into captive, which was a huge proportion of the population of the land at the time. And Ahaz was followed by Hezekiah, who was the other king who lived while Hosea was prophesying. And Hezekiah was 25 years old when he came to the throne, and he reigned in Jerusalem for 29 years. And he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, as his ancestor David had done. And Hezekiah went on and restored the temple, which Ahaz had closed the temple down and desecrated it, and Hezekiah rebuilt it. So there you go. You have another king who tried to return the... And so you can sort of see the narrative. And this is going through in the land of Judah, the southern kingdom. Meanwhile, in the northern kingdom was King Jeroboam. Jeroboam the second. There are actually two King Jeroboams in Israel, so don't get them confused if you're ever thumbing through a concordance. And what we read about Jeroboam, well, we read quite a lot about Jeroboam, but what we read about him here in particular is this. It says that in the 15th year of Amaziah, son of Joash, king of Judah, Jeroboam became king in Samaria. So Samaria being the northern kingdom, and he reigned for 41 years. And he did what was wrong in the eyes of the Lord. He didn't give up the sinful practices of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, who led Israel into sin. He reestablished the frontiers of Israel from Lebo Hamath to the Sea of Arabah in fulfillment of the way of the Lord, the God spoken by his servant, the prophet Jonah, son of Amittai. And so, hang on, I've probably confused you with lots of names here. Let's go through it again. We had four kings in the southern kingdom. Three of them worshipped the Lord, and one of them told the people to worship Baal and Asherah. And we've got a king in the northern kingdom who did nothing but lead the people to worship Baal and Asherah. And I told you that in the southern kingdom, prosperity went with the kings who worshipped the Lord. And it was a terrible time when Ahaz was king, who was worshipping Baal and Asherah. But I've also just told you that here in the northern kingdom, you've got a king who loves all the sacrifices of children and the orgies and so on. He loves all that, and yet he was enormously successful. And in fact, it was he who managed to slaughter 120,000 people from the southern kingdom. And so Hosea's like writing at a time when the Israelites, the people from the northern kingdom, they're looking at it and saying, this is the richest we've ever been. Jeroboam the second was the most successful king that the northern nation of Israel had ever had, if you measure success in terms of the strength of the economy, in terms of trade, in terms of dealing with his enemies, in terms of military successes. It was a great time to be alive. And yet he was leading people in the sacrifice of children and in their worship of Baal and Asherah. How can you make sense of that? And it's a common complaint. You read it, you read this kind of complaint in the Bible quite often. You might be familiar with Psalm 33, where Asaph writes this. He says, my feet had almost slipped. My foothold had all but given way. What upset Asaph? What upset him? Because boasters roused my envy when I saw how the wicked prosper. No painful suffering for them. They're sleek and sound in body. They're not in trouble like ordinary mortals, nor are they afflicted like other folk. Therefore they wear pride like a necklace and violence like a robe that wraps them round. And their eyes gleam through the folds of fat while vain fancies flit through their minds. Their talk is all mockery and malice. High-handedly they threaten oppression, their slanders reach up to heaven, while their tongues are never still on earth. So the people follow their lead and find in them nothing blameworthy. They say, how does God know? Does the Most High know or care? Such are the wicked, unshakably secure, they pile up wealth. Indeed, it was for nothing that I kept my heart pure. Common complaint. Why is it? Why does it happen that an evil king like Jeroboam II can be so prosperous? And the one thing we see when we look through the history of the Old Testament is that there is no tight coupling between prosperity and honouring God. If you think that honouring God is the way to having a bigger car or a nicer house, then you're doing the wrong thing. God doesn't promise to prosper us in quite those ways. So with that as background, let's learn a little bit more about Hosea. And in Hosea, then, it's an unusual prophet because it's got a bit of narrative and some explanation to it. And the narrative starts like this. It says, "This is the beginning of the Lord's message given to Hosea. He said, 'Go and take an unchaste woman as your wife, and with this woman have children. For like an unchaste woman, this land is guilty of unfaithfulness to the Lord.'" So Hosea was told to go and marry someone. He was told to go and marry a woman called Gomer. And Gomer is a horrendously unfaithful wife. She has many other men as lovers. And Hosea and Gomer have three children. Well, do they or don't they? We know that Gomer had three children, but the parentage of the children is pretty unclear. There were two boys, one of them called Jezreel, and the second boy was called Lo-Ammi, which means not my son. So I think it's fairly clear where Hosea thought that child came from. He had a daughter called Lo-Ruhamah, which means not loved. Again, it suggests that this was not his child. And the distress that Hosea feels is evident. And again, you know, we're at it again. Hosea, he's done what God told him. God said, go and marry this woman Gomer. And look at the misery that's been brought to him in his life as she runs off with other men and has children with them. And so Hosea divorces her. In chapter 2, verse 2, it says this. Call your mother to account. He's talking to his children. Call your mother to account, for she is no longer my wife, nor am I her husband. So he divorces her, and chapter 2 of Hosea is his complaint against what Gomer's done. He says, look, he talks about his wife, he says, look, you've lived as a prostitute. You've sold yourself to other men, and the immoral earnings that you've made on that, you've spent them all on Baal worship. And even the things that I've given to you, the gifts that I've given you, you've taken them down to the shrines of Asherah and you've spent them on Baal worship. I, as a prophet of the Lord, and you've done that as my wife. And the distress in Gomer couldn't have brought Hosea more unhappiness, no matter what she'd done. The thing that mattered to him as the prophet of the Lord was serving God, and his wife was giving everything that he gave to her to spend it at the shrines of Baal and Asherah. And she was with other men, and although he'd done what God had asked, then he had this misery. And so he divorced his wife, and you sort of have this picture of Hosea sitting, tears running down his face outside his house. He's done what God asked, and he's miserable. Why on earth did God put Hosea through such a horrendous time? God did it because it was the only way that he could make his people understand how he felt when they turned their back on him. Back at something we read right at the beginning of the book of Hosea. It says, go and take an unchaste woman as your wife, and with this woman have children, for like an unchaste woman, this land is guilty of unfaithfulness to the Lord. And we can put ourselves in Hosea's position and imagine how he felt, because we're human. And in imagining how Hosea felt at the behavior of Gomer, his wife, we can see how God feels when we're unfaithful to him. It's just the same. And we might think of our unfaithfulness to God as being something kind of trivial and personal and not mattering very much. But it wrenches God's heart just as surely as Gomer wrenched Hosea's heart apart. And we don't have any Baalim in Britain. We don't have idols out there. There's no Asherah shrine in Asherah pole or tree that we can hold a party to Baal under in Penarth. We haven't got that. Our gods are more subtle. And our gods might appear to sometimes be good, but they can be dangerously alluring. The gods of education, the gods of success, whatever that is in sport or art or business, whatever you count as success, are gods of leisure. Things that in and of themselves are not harmful, but things that get in and tear the life out of a Christian if we let them get out of control. And when these things displace God, then we're like Gomer was to Hosea. When we allow our God of education to twist the character of the Christian, and so we begin to value people more for the letters they have after their name than for what they are as a person, then we've begun to worship the God of education, and we're wrenching God's heart the way that Gomer wrenched Hosea's heart. When our integrity suffers as a way to achieving success in business or sport or whatever our walk of life is, when we throw our integrity onto the fire in order to achieve success, we've allowed the God of success to displace the Lord in our lives. And we've been unfaithful to God just as surely as Gomer was unfaithful to Hosea. When we can't be bothered to do God's work, and our pursuit of leisure displaces the work that we would otherwise be doing for God, we've been unfaithful to God just as surely as when the Israelites worshipped Asherah and Baal. And it's interesting as well to see sometimes when we look at ways in which we can be unfaithful to God, where God puts the blame for some of the behaviour in Hosea's day. Something very modern said in chapter 4 and verse 14, God says through Hosea, "I will not punish your daughters for becoming prostitutes." How strong is that? I will not punish your daughters for becoming prostitutes or your sons' brides for their adultery, because your men resort to whores and sacrifice with temple prostitutes. He says the blame's not with the women. The blame's with the men who are creating the demand. Which contrasts quite strongly, doesn't it, with attitudes in many countries in the world where the victims of rape are blamed for their rape rather than those who are committing the crime. And perhaps in our day, then, God might have said something else like this: "I will not punish your gang masters because you demanded that they provide you with cheap food and clothing and luxury goods." Perhaps that's what God might say to us. We have to remember that we are the rich and the powerful, and the things that we do can be causing others to sin against God. But the story doesn't end with a divorce. And I ask myself, how would I feel if I was Hosea? Gomer has gone away. She's with another man. Surely the hurt is over. Time to close a chapter. You've been wronged. She deserves what she's got. Glad to see the back of her. Move on and find someone else more suitable. This is the kind of way that we might think as people. But Hosea still loves Gomer. And he says this, Hosea still loves Gomer, but she seems to have an owner. Perhaps she's in slavery, or perhaps she's been remarried, I don't know. She still has lovers, but he wants her back. And this is what we find in chapter 3. He says, "The Lord said to me, 'Go again and bestow your love on a woman loved by another man, an adulteress. Love her as I, the Lord, love the Israelites, although they resort to gods and love the cakes of raisins offered to idols.'" He goes back to Gomer, despite everything that she's done, and he buys her back. "So I bought her for 15 pieces of silver, a homer of barley and a measure of wine, and I said to her, 'You will live in my house for a long time, and you will not lead an immoral life.'" He buys her back, even though she was really his in the first place. And what I find interesting is what Hosea then tells us that means about God's people. And we get on to the passage that Josie read to us. And you know, there are many things that are uncertain in life. I think it was Benjamin Franklin who said that nothing's certain except death and taxes. But there is actually something more certain than death or taxes. And I see that when I go out cycling. I mean, you might have noticed that I enjoy a bit of cycling. And my Garmin, which sort of tells me, you know, how fast I'm, or how slow I'm going, but more tragically. My Garmin, which tells me how slow I'm going, it knows when the sun comes up, when the sun goes down. And when it's before sunset, then the writing is white on a black background, so it doesn't dazzle your eyes. And then when the sun comes up, it changes over, so it's black writing on a black on a white background, so that you can kind of, you don't get, you can read it more clearly in bright sunlight. So my Garmin knows when the sun's coming up. And if I were to go to Russia or China, then the Garmin would cleverly sort of change itself and it would go black and white at the right time as the sun sets and rises in that particular place. Because the sunrise is completely reliable. It changes from day to day, but we know exactly when it's going to happen. We've got no power to change sunrise despite our technology. You know, we can damage the atmosphere, we can spoil the planet, we can mess with the climate, but we can't change the time of sunrise. It is completely fixed. We know when the sun rose in the Celts and the Egyptians. We know when it rises anywhere in the world from Easter Island to the Kamchatka Peninsula. And the other thing that I've noticed as a cyclist is that it rains quite a lot in Wales, and that when it rains, the plants grow. And this year has been an interesting one, because it's been a warm year, but it's rained a lot. And by heck, it's made a lot of difference to the plants. I've seen nettles 8 feet tall, and I've been stung by them when I've tried cycling past them as well. I mean, it's astonishing how fecund, how fertile the earth is when the sun comes up and the rain comes. Plants need light and water and warmth. Moisture and the sun produces fecundity. Well, I think that Hosea must have been a cyclist, a mountain biker, because he noticed all that. And so he tells us this in the passage that Josie read to us. Come, let us return to the Lord. He's torn us, but he'll heal us. He's wounded us, but he'll bind up our wounds. After 2 days, he'll revive us. On the third day, he'll raise us to live in his presence. And this is it. Let us strive to know the Lord, whose coming is as sure as the sunrise. How certain is that, right? God's coming is as sure as the sunrise. Absolutely certain. More certain than death or taxes. It will come. His coming is as sure as the sunrise. And what will happen when he comes? He'll come to us like the rain, like the spring rains that water the earth. And when he comes, you get a time of fecundity, a time of fertility, a time of growth, a time of blessing. And just as Hosea first loved Gomer, God first loved us. And just as Hosea wept at Gomer's behavior, God weeps at ours. And just as Hosea continued to love Gomer, God continues to love us. And just as Hosea redeemed Gomer, then God redeemed us through Jesus. And if we strive to know the Lord, then his coming is as certain as the sunrise. Despite what we are, and despite what we will be, his coming will bring spiritual fecundity. No promise of prosperity, but a promise of God's presence. And he wants your life to be as rich and overflowing with blessing as a rainforest, in the sun and full of rain. John 10:10 says this, I've come that they may have life and have it to the full. But he's only promised that if we strive. You know, that's what Hosea says. He says, let us strive to know the Lord. Striving is not something that happens by accident. This is something where we're chasing after knowing God. And alternatives might be more attractive. The equivalents of the Baals and the Asherahs in our land, the success and the education, these things are attractive. They're what everyone else around us does. And this is more than a casual encounter with the Lord. And so what I think that Hosea is saying to us is this. Maybe God feels distant to you. Maybe he doesn't at the moment, but for sure at some point in the future, you'll be in a place where God feels distant. Because that's the Christian experience. We ebb and we flow in our love for him. So maybe God is distant, or maybe he will be distant. And we all have friends who once knew the Lord, but have now fallen away. And God's saying this, let's strive to know him. And if we strive to know him, and teach others to strive to know him, he will appear. And you know, I've seen Christians who've refused to acknowledge that others who've fallen away could ever be restored. I've seen Christians who, when they've seen others who've been restored, refuse to acknowledge them because their past is too bad. But God is prepared to accept back people who worshipped Baal and Asherah. If he's prepared to accept back people who sacrificed their children to idols, it doesn't matter what we do, he'll have us back. And so when we see people who've hurt us, and they've perhaps hurt us at a time when they were spiritually low, and they come back, let's remember, if they're striving to know the Lord, he will appear, and he will return to them. He'll return to us. Let's acknowledge the Lord, and he'll come to us like the winter rains, as surely as the sun rises.